Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest is Mark Bittman, who is one of the country's best-known and most widely respected food writers, and I'll be inviting him on in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in the news and some things going on in and around our city that you might want to take advantage of. This weekend, lots of things are going on. Of course, there's the Riverkeepers Sweep, which is the third annual day of service on the Hudson River, to help clean it up. And if the weather cooperates, it should be a really wonderful time. And it's taking place all along the Hudson River, so you can go onto the Riverkeepers website to find out locations near you. This weekend, the Edible Community publication is sponsoring their Edible Institute at the New School in Manhattan. And that's all day Saturday and Sunday, and you can go onto their website to buy tickets. The keynote speaker actually on Saturday is Mark Bittman, who will be on in just a little bit, so we can talk about that. May 13th, Michael Pollan will be speaking up at the 92nd Street Y if you want to buy tickets for that. May 17th, next weekend, there's a run for a run fast for Slow Food New York City that's sponsoring Slow Foods annual producer summit, which is a conference that's going to be taking place in November. So if you come to this run, you will be helping to support next fall's summit. What else? Oh, and then there's a gathering at the end of the run at the Print Restaurant, which is a wonderful restaurant. I actually checked it out for my birthday last month. It was really a nice evening. May 24th, March Against Monsanto, and that's everywhere. So you can go on to March Against Monsanto, Google that, and you'll find out where there are events near you. Also, I am sponsoring a socially responsible investing dinner. That's going to be taking place at a private home in Lloyd Harbor. And I have been working with some folks from Morgan Stanley to divest any money in companies that are affiliated with the likes of Monsanto or any fossil fuel companies. And there's been a big push already for a couple of years, started by 350.org, to divest our money from any fossil fuel companies. And now Monsanto, divesting from that, is on board as well. There's actually a National Day of Action to divest from Monsanto, and you can find out information about that on my website at iegreen.com. There's also a petition going on that I'd like to invite you to take part of, and it's for Amy's Bread workers. Amy's Bread, which many of you know, I mean, they have a great bakery in the Chelsea Market, and they're all over the place, and they really promote themselves as a good, clean, and fair company. However, it's come to many people's attention through the workers that they're not really being paid a fair, livable wage. And I'm really happy to say that this issue of fair labor wages is really becoming a part of this good food movement. And it's really important that we take a look behind the kitchen door, as I've had on my show before, Saru, take a look at the fair labor wages that people are being paid, and can they work a full-time job and support themselves here in the city? And so many of these workers at Amy's Bread, they're working three jobs just to make ends meet. And so something is broken, and so they're asking for our support. So on my website, you'll find a petition that you can sign in for that. Also, we want to let Chuck Schumer, our senator, know that we do not support fracking. He actually came out and said, you know, that most people in New York support fracking. And the reality is, just a few days ago, front page of the New York Times, I think it was Tuesday, talked about climate change as really being, you know, an issue that we really have to take seriously. And Obama has, you know, spoken out and talked about, you know, being the president that's really going to address climate change. However, he is a big proponent supporting fracking. And fracking is the process of drilling down into the shale rock and not only exploding millions of gallons of fresh water, which is a resource that we cannot just squander, but also proprietary chemicals that they won't tell us what they are, and releasing the gas that has been locked up in the shale rock. However, it also releases methane into the environment, which is far worse greenhouse gas emission than CO2. And so we really need to start connecting the dots. We're seeing the effects of global warming. We're seeing droughts. We're seeing floods. We're seeing horrible storms and tornadoes. And, you know, that's just from the atmosphere heating up 2 degrees. Well, they're now saying that, you know, by the end of this century, it could heat up 10 degrees. What will happen when that happens? And so we really need to connect the dots. And one of those dots is the issue about fracking. And so we cannot squander our fresh water, which is a non-reusable or renewable resource. We have a limited amount of fresh water on the planet, and that's it. So to spend millions of dollars per well, millions of gallons per well for fracking just doesn't make sense. So anyway, there's a petition on my website to tell Schumer that you do not want to support that. Also, the Environmental Working Group came out with their 2014 Shopper's Guide, which is a guide to pesticides and produce. And it's a really great list. Every year I remind everybody to use that as a guide. I mean, buying organic food is a wonderful thing, and, you know, it's an ideal that we can all strive for. But let's face it, it's more expensive, and many people can't afford it. So if you can't afford it, this list is a wonderful tool to have. You can actually download an app onto your smartphone, and it will tell you the most important, you know, starting by the most pesticides on apples, going all the way down. And the first 12 things are apples, strawberries, grapes, celery, peaches, spinach, sweet bell peppers, nectarines, cucumbers, cherry tomatoes, snap peas, and potatoes, and hot peppers and blueberries if you want to go to 14. But anyway, those are the worst fruits and vegetables to purchase non-organic. So if you're only going to buy a few things that are organic, try to use this Dirty Dozen list as a guide. And by doing that, you'll really be cutting your pesticide intake by a lot. Okay, what else is going on? Every Sunday, the first Sunday of every month out here at Restoration Farm, there's going to be live music from 2 to 5 at the CSA site in Old Bethpage Village. And Restoration Farm's another one of these wonderful CSAs around. If you haven't joined a CSA yet, some CSAs still have spots. That's Community Supported Agriculture. And it's a great way to be getting the freshest local vegetables into your kitchen at a reasonable price. So shop around for that. So I'd like to share with you this week's recipe. Every week I bring you a recipe, and then I post it on my website, and it's also posted on the Progressive Radio Network's website. This week it's a gluten-free fig, goat cheese, and caramelized onion pizza. And this time of year when the fresh figs come out, it always makes me want to make one of these cheese pizzas, and I wanted to share the recipe with all of you. Udi's products, they make some really great ones, some not as good ones, but the Udi gluten-free pie crusts are delicious, and they're an individual size pizza shell, and it's just so easy to just have those in your freezer, and anytime you need to just whip out a lunch for some people that stop by, this is a great go-to that you can have in the freezer. I make this using the goat cheese. If you wanted to leave off the cheese and just make it a vegetable pizza, you can do that too, because the caramelized onions are so sweet that they add a really wonderful flavor to the pizza, and you can always add some more vegetables. So this makes two individual pizzas. You're going to start with one package of the Udi crust, which come two in a pack, some olive oil, two onions cut into thin slivers, some balsamic vinegar, a pint of fresh figs cut into quarter wedges, 1 5-ounce log of the organic goat cheese, and a quarter cup of shredded organic mozzarella cheese, and then fresh parsley for garnish. So I first brush the crust with a little bit of olive oil. Then I saute the onions in a little olive oil until they start to brown. And let them cook for a good 10 minutes, just till they really, really sweeten up and get brown. And then you drizzle a little bit of the balsamic vinegar, about a teaspoon, onto them and continue cooking them until they're fully caramelized. Then you spread the onions out onto both crusts evenly. Divide the goat cheese between the two pizzas and crumble the goat cheese all over the top, and then sprinkle the top with mozzarella. Place the figs all around the pizzas, you know, so you decorate it really pretty. And then you bake it in a 450 to 500 degree oven on a cookie sheet for about 6 minutes. And then when you pull it out, just garnish it with that fresh chopped parsley, and that's it. And like I said, if you want to make this vegan, you can just add some more vegetables to that. I've been roasting a lot of vegetables this time of year, and you just, you know, toss the vegetables with some olive oil, some fresh garlic, put it in and some molten salt. Those salt crystals are just so great. And put them into the oven, let them cook up, and then just add them to the pizza. You can either do it before you cook it or afterwards. If you already have the roasted vegetables, you can just decorate the top of the pizza when it comes out of the oven with the warm roasted vegetables, and it's great that way too. If you choose to use some rice cheese, you can do that, but believe me, it's not necessary, and these are great. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest on, Mark Bittman. As I said, he's one of the country's best-known, most widely respected food writers, and he has some great books out, How to Cook Everything books. I have with me the How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, which, you know, is a great go-to book. Has every kind of vegetable in there. If you want to just know how to prepare something, you see something at the farmer's market, you don't know what to do with it, this is a great book to go to. And last year he came out with the New York Times number one bestseller, VB6. And I'm happy to say this week he just came out with a companion book called the VB6 Cookbook, which has a bunch of wonderful recipes, actually 350 recipes, all gearing towards his VB6 diet, which I'm going to let Mark tell us about right now. Mark, are you on? Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I apologize for that technical difficulty. We lost the connection for a little while, but I'm back. And as I said, my guest today is Mark Bittman, who is one of the country's best-known, most widely respected food writers. His How to Cook Everything books have sold over a million copies, and I have here right next to me How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, which has been one of my go-to books when I see a new vegetable at the farmer's market and don't know what to do with it. It's a great, great book. And last year he came out with a book called VB6, which debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And this week, I'm so happy to say, he actually came out with a companion book called the VB6 Cookbook, which, you know, has over 350 recipes to complement this new way of eating that Mark has introduced to all of us. So, Mark, are you on?
I sure am.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Great. So, can you share with us a little bit about, you know, I just want to backtrack a little about your life story, like how did you first become a food writer, and when did you first start your career cooking?
Long time ago. So
I know.
I was a writer, I was a cook, and I managed to combine the two. So that goes back 35 years. It's not really all that interesting.
And when you came out with the book VB6, can you share with us, you know, what was your inspiration behind that?
Yes, of course I can. I think that in the late 90s, early 2000s, it became clear to most people who were paying attention to food that the writing was on the wall, that we were going to have to move towards a plant-based diet. And thinking that, I decided to write How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, not because I wanted to be a vegetarian, I didn't and I don't, but because I thought it was important to become more familiar with cooking plant foods. And during the course of that, the links between what you might call the standard American diet and our ever-growing health crisis and, in fact, our environmental crisis and even global warming became increasingly clear. And that also coincided with me becoming a late middle-aged person and having most of the chronic diseases or signs of the most of the chronic diseases that are associated with that. So I decided it was time for me to do something about my diet, and VB6 is what I came up with, because I, recognizing that plant foods should form the basis of a sound diet, but unwilling and to become a pure vegan, I thought, well, why don't I just become a mostly vegan? And I arranged my day so that I ate unprocessed fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes, whole grains, plants, in other words, from morning until night. And then at night I went back to sort of an omnivorous flexitarian diet and ate whatever I want. And lo and behold, I lost a lot of weight, my cholesterol levels went down, and all of that good stuff happened. And now it's 7 years later. I've been doing this for 7 years. This is my second book on the subject. Many other people do it too. Part-time veganism is a, if not a fad, it's a recognized thing. And here we are with a cookbook that I think is interesting for its combination of vegan and non-vegan recipes. I'd say two-thirds of the recipes are vegan and probably one-third are what you might call flexitarian.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume, and I think I know from reading it, this happened too, that just by changing your diet and eating vegan for breakfast and lunch, even though you still planned on eating everything that you always ate at night, didn't that diet of being vegan morning and afternoon affect your choices when it came time to eat at night?
Yeah, it did, and that was a sort of unexpected outcome. I felt like I was more conscious generally, and I think my volume generally went down, although that's not necessarily cause and effect, because I am getting older, so people do tend to eat less as they get older. But yes, that was, but I do want to stress that I don't, at no time thought I was going to go vegan or become a vegan, and I still don't intend to, but it's true that my diet has, not only am I vegan all day long, but at night I eat way less meat, way fewer animal products than I used to, sometimes as often as little as half an ounce or an ounce, really just seeing meat as a treat or as a condiment on other dishes. So, yeah, things have definitely changed.
Mm-hmm. Right now you're also hosting a documentary called Years of Living Dangerously. Can you share with us what that documentary is about?
Years of Living Dangerously is a Showtime mm-hmm. documentary that is running for 8 weeks. I'm in the fifth and sixth week. There are a bunch of people in it, including Matt Damon, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Ian Somerhalder, Leslie Stahl, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm one of the correspondents. And basically the show is an attempt to demonstrate that climate change is personal. And we've gone all over the world and looked at places where there's been evidence of the effects of climate change and how that has affected ordinary people and regular living situations. So I did, my work was on sea level rise in New Jersey, specifically after Superstorm Sandy, and I also worked on the escape of methane gas in Colorado and Utah, and how important that is as a climate change generator. Your question's well timed, since just yesterday there was a big report saying, guess what, folks, climate change is here. And while our show demonstrated that, there hasn't been a sort of official recognition of that, but now there is.
Right. It's amazing to me with President Obama, speaking out, saying he's going to be the president that's going to really do something, and yet he's promoting fracking, which is, one of the you know, which is not only using up our natural resource of fresh water, but it's also releasing methane into the environment, which is far worse than carbon dioxide. And so through this exploration that you've been doing with VB6 and your work with Living Dangerously, can you share with some of the people listening the connections between climate change and our industrial food system?
There are a variety of different sources of carbon emissions and methane emissions from industrial agriculture, and they come from, you know, everything from cow belches to transportation. There are many ways we could be sequestering carbon that we're not, but instead we're squandering it. And this makes agriculture, if not the largest generator of greenhouse gases, then the second largest generator of greenhouse gases.
Any suggestions? Do you think that people changing their diet towards a more vegan-friendly diet will have an impact on...
Yeah, absolutely, because meat, you know, in industrial agriculture, the biggest greenhouse gas generator is the cow, or the production of beef. So certainly if you cut back on your consumption of beef, you're cutting back on your personal carbon footprint. The same is true to a lesser extent of pork and to an even lesser extent of chicken, but animal products are in industrial agriculture, animal products are, by being the top of the food chain, the biggest generators of greenhouse gases.
On Tuesday, you wrote an interesting opinion article in the New York Times, you know, discussing the buzzwords organic and GMOs, and kind of feeling like by the food movement focusing on these two words a little bit too much, that we were kind of not getting our point across, or maybe turning some people off a little bit. Can you explain a little bit why you think the focusing on these issues is not the best way to get our message across?
Well, GMOs are not scary to me. They're being misused. Probably causing the rise of herbicide-resistant weeds that wouldn't exist otherwise. But it's not dangerous to eat foods that are – it doesn't seem to be dangerous to eat foods that are made from plants that are grown using genetically modified seeds.
You don't think the increase of allergies is at all connected to
– No, I don't. And I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
So – I think there are many, many, many more issues that are far scarier. I'm not in favor of using genetically modified organisms in the way that they're being used now, which is to support industrial agriculture. I'm not saying that I'm in favor of that. I'm saying I'm far more scared of the overuse of antibiotics in industrial agriculture than I am of the use of GMOs, because there is evidence right now here that antibiotics are losing their effectiveness. And they're losing their effectiveness because they're being used way too much as prophylactic preventers of diseases in animals. And you need those antibiotics in animal production because the animals are being treated so badly. That's really scary, and that's here and now. You know, We could grow old, get pneumonia, and have no antibiotics to keep us from dying. That's a really scary thing. I don't see anything nearly as scary as that coming out of GMOs. So the focus on GMOs, I think, is a mistake. I'm not saying I support the use of GMOs in agriculture as it stands, but I think to try to whip up hysteria around that is not only a waste of energy, but makes us look like we don't know what we're talking about. So that's the GMO thing. The organic thing is, I'm totally in favor of organic food. Obviously not, there's not enough of it being produced. It's expensive. Not everyone can afford it. And people can eat better without eating organic food. And that's, you know, to some extent, that's what VB6 is about.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. However, I guess I feel like transparency is so important. So many people in this country, even today, you know, you and I, we're reading about food all the time, and we, you know, are very much on top of it. But I think there's still a lot of people, even today, that still don't even know what a GMO is, or don't know what the difference between organic or non-organic is.
That's really true.
It is. And I think, you know, that piece of the education so that people can make a choice. I mean, I think that's important. And
I totally agree. And I'm totally in favor of, I mean, I think the one, if GMO labeling is the thin end of the wedge, that is to say, if we're going to have more transparency as a result of GMO labeling, I think that's a pretty good thing. Again, I would rather know what pesticides are being used on my food and what the residues are. I'd rather know how many antibiotics are being used in my food. I don't know how much stuff you can convince people to put on a label.
Right.
But if GMO labeling comes about by whipping up a frenzy of hysteria that really ignores the science, I think that's a problem, because we need to look like we know what we're talking about. And if we are hysterical about the wrong things, then we look like we're anti-science, and it's easy to discredit us. And I think that's what's happening with GMOs.
Mm-hmm. Although part of the problem, I think, is that the science is always being supported by the biotech companies, so that there's not quite enough money to really do the proper science and testing.
Excellent point.
The GMOs.
Well, yeah, and there's a big, you know, it always is going to come down to convincing government to spend money on the things we think money should be spent on. And I agree there should be more research done on GMOs, but it should be independent, academic, non-industry research. I totally agree with that.
Right. Trying to find the money is the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem.
Right. So, for instance, in Europe, because at first they didn't even allow GMOs. There was a moratorium on it. But once they started allowing GMOs, they did require labeling. And a result of that was that most of the products that are made here in the U.S. market, they also make for the European market, but they make them without GMOs, because the manufacturers felt like if they had to label their products that they contain GMOs, that they would be looked at as inferior, and they didn't want to have to do that. So instead of labeling, they actually chose to make the product GMO-free. And for me, I see the wonderful repercussion of that is that if there's more demand for non-GMO products, it will require farmers, because right now there wouldn't even be enough product, GMO-free product, to meet the demand if all of a sudden every Triscuit had to be GMO-free and every processed food needed to be GMO-free. There wouldn't be enough corn and soybeans. So, you know, I think the side of, you know, the labeling law, one of the wonderful side effects of it would be that it would be encouraging farmers to make the transition towards growing non-GMO products, just so that they could meet the demand. What do you think about that?
If you're saying that labeling will cause a decrease in GMO products, I think that's probably right, but I don't see that a decrease in GMO. Look, we didn't have GMOs until 1995, and we sure had industrial agriculture in 1995.
Sure.
So I don't know that taking GMO products out of the marketplace, it may even result in an increase in the use of herbicides. I mean, I don't know what the result of that is. I'm not sure it's beneficial. I'm not saying I want them in the marketplace, but it's a lot of energy to get something out of the marketplace that is not going to change things that much.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm not entirely sure why you're bringing the conversation back to that, which is fine with me, but I'm not entirely sure why you're not picking up on an opportunity to discuss how are we going to reduce the amount of antibiotics in our food supply? How are we going to reduce the amount of pesticides and herbicides used in agriculture, neither of which have anything to do with GMOs, and both of which are far more threatening than GMOs?
Right. Well, actually, I guess my understanding is that the use of GMOs has resulted in more use of pesticides and herbicides because of the super bugs and super weeds that have resulted through the mutations of the GMO.
But we've had 20 years of pretty much 90% of all corn and soybeans being grown with GMO. So we don't know what other insecticides, herbicides, pesticides would be used if there were no GMOs, and perhaps we'd have super weeds anyway. It's industrial agriculture that's the problem here. It's not just GMOs. As I said in that column, it's like saying dynamite is the problem and forgetting that there's a war going on.
Mm-hmm. So what is your suggestion on how to reduce the amount of antibiotics? I mean, how do we change the industrial food system? Because obviously we know that that's broken and that does need to be changed. What do you think, people going towards a more plant-based diet and just eating less meat in general will help change that?
Well, that's certainly what we can do on a personal level, but I think we need to be pushing the Food and Drug Administration to make the new antibiotic rulings not voluntary but mandatory. They've asked the industry to stop using antibiotics as growth enhancers, and they've asked them to stop using antibiotics as prophylactic disease preventers. But they haven't asked them to stop using antibiotics routinely, and they certainly haven't mandated that, and that would be a really important step.
Right, right. Because there's also the issue of secondhand contamination. Just by eating those animals that are being fed those antibiotics is affecting us as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I wanted to jump back to your book because I only received it yesterday and started looking through it, and it's really great. Can you share with us some of your favorite recipes from the book?
I happen to be a huge fan of this tofu chorizo, which I think sort of demonstrates that meat substitutes do not need to be super complicated and made from weird powders, but you can actually use traditional things like tofu and cook them and make them pretty much indistinguishable from meat. So that is that's among my favorites. The ginger kale banana smoothie is really, really great. There's a quinoa salad I like a lot. And also, as I said before, I think some of the dinner dishes in which small amounts of meat are incorporated are, I won't say revolutionary, but I think they point in the right direction for a new way of eating.
Mm-hmm. I was just looking at the corp corn. What is that? Corp corn. A combination of two. Popcorn,
the combination of popcorn.
What's...
and gorp. I think you've gorp. Got gorp corn. So, yeah. I mean, basically, we're trying to figure out ways to make snacks that are easy to put together, very portable, and pretty healthy. So, you know, when you look at trail mix now, you see it often has M&Ms in it, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, here's
right.
the thing that started as a benign, relatively benign combination of nuts and raisins, and now it's got M&Ms or chocolate chips or both.
Right, same with yogurt with sprinkles.
Right, well, yogurt itself with sugar. And, you know, same with popcorn with cheese. So we thought we'd try to make a sort of more interesting popcorn. So it is a combination of popcorn and gorp, basically.
Uh-huh. And what about the tofu jerky? That was really good.
Worked on that really, really hard, I have to say. We probably did 10 iterations of that. And I think we've got it right. I'm waiting to hear what people have to say about that. But I have had tofu jerky that I really enjoy. This is among them. And, again, it shows that you don't need fancy high-tech meat substitutes. Tofu is, you know, the two-ingredient, three-ingredient product that uses soybeans and a coagulant. So really a two-ingredient product, three if you include salt. That's been made for hundreds of years and can take on many guises. You know, and it's not that I'm a huge tofu booster, although I actually have come to like it, but just that people think that when they reduce the amount of animal products in their diet, they need substitutes. And I would argue that there are traditional substitutes that are better than some of the high-tech substitutes we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. In yesterday's food section, they were just talking about, you know, celebrating the vegetable and how, you know, the vegetable is really starting to take more center stage. And I think more and more chefs are really paying attention to where the vegetables actually coming from and celebrating the actual flavor of the vegetable. do you find in your cookbook, do you focus on that a bit of like procuring, you know, seasonal food and the foods coming freshest out of the garden?
I've always been a fan of seasonal food, and I mean, even going back to how to cook everything, so that's nothing new to me. You know, vegetables are a fantastic food option. The fact that chefs are recognizing it doesn't surprise me. And chefs, of course, often have access to even higher quality stuff than most of us do. I actually only have time for one more question, so.
Okay. Can you suggest to parents what they can do to protect their kids from the bombardment of the marketing of junk foods to help improve their diets?
Such a huge question.
Well, I had to make it a big one. It's
yeah,
last one.
It's such a, no, and it's such a good question and such a powerful one. You know, I think there's got to be a movement around this, because marketing junk to kids is, I think, one of the, if I had to say five issues that were of top importance to people concerned about food, I would put marketing junk to kids up in that top five. I really would. So what can be done? I mean, one thing is to work on an extremely local level and get involved in your own school and try to get marketing, you know, out of your own school system. Another is to work locally to start getting politicians, to start nailing politicians on these questions. We never question politicians on what their positions are around food, and I think it's important that we start to do so. And the question, how do you stand on marketing junk food to children, is a question that should be asked of everybody that's running for public office.
That's perfect. You're right. And it is an issue that's, you know, usually not talked about. And it is such an important one. I know it was a really big conversation, you know, in the mayoral race. And, you know, I think it's one that just has to continue, because the school food, you know, you're trying to teach kids about healthy food, and then they go into the cafeteria and what they're being fed is completely contradictory to what they're being told they should be eating. So anyway, Mark, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. And everybody who's a mother out there, you might want to consider, have a wonderful Mother's Day. And those that have mothers and want to purchase a wonderful gift, I'd recommend Mark's new book, VB6 Cookbook.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye. And everyone who's listening, I want to thank you for joining us. It has been a wonderful show, and I know we're ending a little early, but I wanted to wish you all a happy, happy Mother's Day, and enjoy the rest of the weekend. Sunday's supposed to be beautiful, so maybe we can plant some flowers around our garden. Have a great rest of the day, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.